Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo 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 Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Canto 3, Chapter 9, Texts 2 and 3. Chapter 9 is entitled Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. And the person speaking is Lord Brahma. The person he's speaking to is Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. The Lord has appeared before him prior to creation, and he's there's a little from chapter 8, there's a slightly modified account from what we're accustomed to hearing, or what transpired prior to creation, after Brahma appeared, how the lotus appeared, and one 1,000 celestial years of penance. No, it's 100 years that says, anyway, the life of Brahma. So he only lives for 100 years. So it's not, there's nothing has been created yet, and time is not yet, like, even in its relative phases, because there isn't creation. 100 years of our time, apparently. So, in chapter 8, it's Maitreya speaking to Vidura about the process of creation, because Maitreya has given some previous explanations, and then Vidura is now asking some further questions about the process of creation, specifically the Visarga, the part of Lord Brahma. What does Brahma do? Because the other is the unfolding of the elements, what Lord Vishnu does. It's a detail, but it's interesting that it comes in the 8th chapter here, that what he's saying, that what he's heard is not what he heard from Krishna when Krishna was speaking Uddhava Gita, because that subject matter isn't covered there in Uddhava Gita, but it's what he heard from Parashara Muni, who heard it from Sankhyayana Muni, who heard it from the four Kumaras, who heard it directly from Lord Sankarshan. So it sounds like, is it Kumara Sampradaya description, but that Kumara Sampradaya description is a little bit different than what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur describes in one book that he wrote on the four Sampradayas. But at least one thing is clear, because Prabhupada states it in the purport, that the Bhagavatam was present before Vyasadeva wrote it. It was present in a oral tradition before he wrote it. Now here Vyasadeva is writing this Bhagavad Purana, and he's describing in it Maitreya describing something that he heard from through the Kumaras, Sankarshan and the Kumaras and that line. So it's an eternal body of wisdom, and what makes it special, besides the cyclic succession, it's about the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. So therefore, Bhagavad Purana. So the ending of chapter 8 was a description of the form of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu that was disclosed to Lord Brahma. And it's a more detailed description than what's found in the second canto of Bhagavatam, where also Lord Brahma comes before Lord Vishnu. So a description of that form, and then he begins his prayers, because he's one thing he's understood through his meditation is that his role is a servant of Lord Vishnu. His role is a servant of that from whom he has come, or that source from which he has come. And then that source is disclosed, so now he's offering prayers leading to what that service is that Vishnu wants him to do. In the first verse, which we discussed in Penn State, is very similar to the first of the Chaturshloki verses from Second Canto, Chapter 9. The first of those Chaturshloki verses says, before the creation, I alone exist. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after cosmic annihilation, I alone exist. That's what Lord Vishnu says to Brahma. Here, this is Brahma speaking to Lord Vishnu, and he's saying it in reverse. It's during the period of cosmic annihilation, specific from Chapter 8, it's a partial annihilation. And Brahma is to recreate that part which is partially annihilated, the part of the universe. And he's, you know, it's not like he takes it for granted that he's got this empowerment from the Supreme Lord. He's praying for creative potency to do that which is his service every morning. It's unchanging. He says, text one, O my Lord, today after many, many years of penance I have come to know about you. Oh, how unfortunate the embodied living entities are that they are unable to know your personality. My Lord, you are only knowable, you are the only knowable object because there is nothing beyond your supreme existence. If there is anything supposedly superior to you, it is not the absolute. You exist as the supreme by exhibiting the creative energy of matter. So that's another Chaturshloki verse. If one sees something, get the Sanskrit. If one sees something of substance and value existing separate from the supreme, know that to be my illusory energy. So he's saying, you're the only worshipable object because you're everything. Before the creation, you're everything. During the creation, you're everything, and after the creation, you're everything. You're the only worshipable object. Even there may be other objects within the creation, they're but an expansion of you, your illusory energy, your creative energy. And if anyone thinks that there's something above your creative energy, and that something is absolute, or that your creative energy is absolute, that's Maya. That's an illusory conception. So, what Brahma is doing in that verse and this morning's verses, 2 and 3, he's establishing the uniqueness, the unique position of the Supreme Lord in a simple way, asamordva, Prabhupada liked that term, over and over again, repeat. The Supreme Lord has no equal, sama, and urdhva, there's no one greater. So the text one is there's no one greater. And you have no competitor. There's not like equal but opposite entity. Like is sometimes portrayed in theology. There is God and there's Satan. And they like the heavyweight championship. They're duking it out, and who's going to win, God or Satan? And God wins, and everyone goes, yay, God wins. Light wins over darkness. And there's so many themes of books and dramas and stories and classics and things where, you know, it's the good and evil struggle. but the Vedic conception that there is not an equal to God, and there's no one greater than God, and all other things that exist come from Him. Or as Prabhupada says, there's only two things: there's God and there's gods, that which comes from Him, and there's not a third thing. So in two texts, 2 and 3, again he's establishing the uniqueness. In part he's establishing the uniqueness between the Lord and himself. You know, this is the master and the servant. And he's not at all unclear about his position as the servant, although in text 3 he speaks of his pride. The pride of the embodied soul is to think, hey, I can do it. I'm the doer. I'm independent. Look at me. I don't have to go anywhere and ask anybody for anything. I'm just going to go and do it. So that tendency, pride tendency, is part of the fallibility of the tiny living entity, and he is making the point that the Supreme Lord is not like that. This form which I see is not like I am. And he, there's several terms that indicate that. Avikalpam, without change, in the body of the Lord, and in the spiritual world, and in the Brahmajyoti, and in his abode, Paravyom, there's no occasional change. Right? Now it's like this, and then later it's like that. There's no such thing. Avikalpam. And then another term is avidhi varchaha, without deterioration of potency. It doesn't come into being and it doesn't fade after time, whereas everything in the material world comes into being and fades after time, without exception. Everything, however long it may endure, comes into being and it fades after time. And in the spiritual sky, specifically speaks of the Brahmajyoti, that's noticeable by its absence. This form that I see isn't like that, and your abode is not like that, and you are not like that. There are two other terms. One is in text 2. Avabodha rasa. Avabodha rasa. Avabodha, Prabhupada explains, is that which completely nullifies. So it's a definition by negation, but that which nullifies the influence of tama, ignorance, or in a broader sense, matter. So I'll read the two verses. Text 2. Brahma speaking. The form which I see is eternally freed from material contamination and has advented to show mercy to the devotees as a manifestation of the internal potency. This incarnation is the origin of many other incarnations. And I am born from the lotus flower, grown from your navel home, N-A-V-E-L. There's another kind of navel, N-A-V-A-L. It's like ships and boats out at sea. This is the other kind, your navel home. Purport. the three deities of Brahma, Vishnu, and Mahesh, Shiva, the executive heads of the three modes of material nature, are all generated from Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who is described herein by Brahma. So, it's very specific. Vishnu is generated from Vishnu, or Kshiradakshay Vishnu is generated from Garbhadakshay Vishnu, and Brahma and Lord Shiva are generated from Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Although Lord Shiva appears as the son of Brahma, statement is the guna avatars are from Vishnu. He just makes his entrance into the world as the son of Brahma. And next sentence, from the Kshiradakshayi Vishnu, many Vishnu incarnations expand at different ages in the duration of the cosmic manifestation. Note that sometimes in different places it speaks of Garbhadakshayi Vishnu as the source of those incarnations. Some places it speaks of them as Kshiradakshayi Vishnu. More commonly, and sometimes that leaves, you know, the scholarly devotees scratching their heads saying, it says this here and says that there, what's going on? And what's going on is the three forms of Vishnu are it's actually one entity with different functions, and so it's not wrong. Just like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that some persons argue different things about, you know, who comes from whom and that those kinds of things. Some people say that Lord Vishnu has four hands, Krishna has two hands, and therefore Lord Vishnu is greater. You got two more hands. And some people say that Krishna is an avatar of Vamanadeva because he appeared before, and Krishna said, Gargamuni said, previously he appeared as this, and in the previous sense that, and now he's Krishna. And so there are, the point is, there are various scriptural statements that seem to contradict one another. But Krishnadas Kaviraj's point is they're not wrong, or they're not factually contradictory. They're just different perceptions of the one absolute truth. And if the picture of the one absolute truth is that Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna, is the source of all of them, and there are various expansions of that Swayam Bhagavan Krishna, and then they further expansions and further expansions, when that central thread is understood, they're not contradictory. They cannot, the puzzle pieces fit together. So here the statement in this purport is that various incarnations of Vishnu expand from Kshiradakshay Vishnu, and that Kshiradakshay Vishnu is expansion of Garbhadakshay Vishnu, as is Lord Brahma, as is Lord Shiva. They are expanded only for the transcendental happiness of the pure devotees, which was in the verse, Lord Brahma is saying, you've made your appearance, as I see it now, for this reason, to enliven your devotees. The incarnations of Vishnu, who appear at different ages and times, are never to be compared to the conditioned souls. So this is, again, uniqueness. Vishnu Tattva and Jiva Tattva are distinct. Anyone who compares them Lord Vishnu to the conditioned souls, or to even Brahma and Vishnu. They are called Pashandi, or infidel. It's interesting that Prabhupada chose that word, because that's what the Islamic people say about the rest of the world. Infidels! You know, it's not a complimentary term. And, they've deviated from the truth, and therefore they're to be crushed by all means, because they're infidels. And our duty is to rid the world's population of infidels. Although that's not what the scripture says. So, Pashandi is one who considers those who are not Vishnu-tattva to be Vishnu-tattva. Like, you know, it's wrong. But more than wrong, it's an offense. Tamasa, mentioned in the verse, Shashvan Nivritta Tamasa, forever free from tamasa, material contamination, or in general, material nature, tamasa, material nature, distinct from spiritual nature. So, tama and uttama, ignorance and beyond ignorance, above ignorance. The personality, so the uniqueness, the personality Vishnu that Brahma is seeing is beyond that influence of material nature. And the spiritual nature mentioned in the verse is this avabodha rasa or avarodha rasa, two different words. Avarodha means that which completely nullifies. In transcendence, there's no chance of material contact by any means. So it's a mystery how the supreme cause, Vishnu, he brings about the material nature, the whole of creation, but he doesn't have anything to do with it. There's no contact with it, and therefore there's no contamination. This is something that I distinctly remember hearing very early in hearing from Srila Prabhupada about the unique position of Lord Vishnu. Unlike Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma, who contact material nature, Lord Vishnu never directly contacts material nature. And that's what this term is meaning. He nullifies tamasa, or avarodha rasa. There's no question of, even by any means, any material contact. The contact with material nature is his glance, but even his glance, like it's like remote, but the glance is Shambhu, and Shambhu contacts material nature, and the Lord is simply glancing. So Shambhu directly contacts, and that's this example of milk in touch with a souring agent becomes dahi. And that's who Shambhu is. And he who doesn't come in contact with material nature is avarodha rasa, this Lord Vishnu. Brahma is the first living being, and therefore, he mentions, his birth from the lotus flower generated from the abdomen of Garbhadaksha Vishnu. Cool, just mention something from chapter 8. before chapter 8, or in chapter 8, there's a description of before there's the lotus flower, and of course then also before there's Lord Brahma. But the time energy has brought about cosmic annihilation, and all of the elements are dissolved and withdrawn within the body of Mahavishnu. But then, because Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is but an expansion of Mahavishnu, during that dormant period there's yoga nidra. Specifically it describes, it appears as if he's asleep, but he's not asleep, and his eyes are not closed. Specifically, his eyes are not closed, but it's yoga nidra. It's just a resting of the function of creation. And then the time energy moves. Not doesn't affect the Supreme Lord, because time and matter don't affect the Supreme Lord. But the time energy on the material plane, although the cosmic manifestation is annihilated, the time energy is still moving. And the time energy comes to the point where it's time for creation. And then when that time for creation arises, the Lord's contemplation, he just contemplates. There should be, there are living entities that are independent from me, and they, I'd like them to become again connected in loving devotion. Just the thought brings rise to this lotus. That's the sum total of the material energy that appears from his navel in a little bud, and then it grows into this. Specifically it says Virat, and the Virat Rupa, and the lotus from his, the stem from his navel, are more or less equated in a one-to-one terminology, just a different name for a different way of looking at what that lotus is. It's a vertical manifestation of the cosmic creation, and then it matures as a lotus flower, and Lord Brahma makes his appearance. So he's referring to that lotus because the first thing that Brahma did was inquire, where have I come from? And he reasons with his reasoning capacity, this lotus upon which I'm sitting has a stem, and if I follow the stem down, go down and down and down and down and down, eventually I'll find out where the stem came from, then I'll find out where I came from. Inductive process. But he climbs and climbs and climbs, and he doesn't find the end to it. He doesn't find Lord Vishnu. Then the light goes on, oh, I'm not going to find out this way. So he goes back and begins his meditation upon the form of the Lord. Although he hasn't seen that form of the Lord. It's specifically, he doesn't know what the form of the Lord is, but he's so sincerely aspiring and striving for that capacity that the Lord shows his form. He sees the form, and now he's describing his position of service unto the Lord. But before the request for enabling him to properly do his service, he's expressing the uniqueness of this form that I see. Okay, so here's text 3. O my Lord, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. Again, uniqueness. In your impersonal Brahman, effulgence, in the spiritual sky, there is no occasional change and no deterioration of internal potency. We discussed at the very beginning those terms. Avikalpam. It certainly makes sense that there's no change within the Brahmajyoti, because all it is light. How do you have change within light? But the creation rests within that light, just like the clouds rest within the sky. And within the sky, there's the light of the sun, and so the clouds are resting in the light of the sun, and the clouds may change, but the light of the sun doesn't change. And there's no deterioration of internal potency. This is again in the Brahmajyoti, but in the Brahmajyoti, all things rest. The spiritual planets rest, the material planet, the whole cosmic manifestation, creation, rests. But in that beyond the touch of the material elements, in that vastness of the spiritual sky, there's no deterioration. There's no beginning and there's no end. So there's no deterioration of his internal potency. And Brahma's understanding that. This form that I see is unique. It's of the same substance as the spiritual sky, and there's no deterioration in the spiritual sky. There's no deterioration of your form, which is different than a material form. There's deterioration in death. There's no coming into being and going out of being for this form that I see. This is your uniqueness. I surrender unto you because, whereas I am proud of my material body and senses, your lordship is the cause of the cosmic manifestation. And yet you are untouched by matter. That's unique. He causes something, but he doesn't touch it to cause it. And it's not to explain that, to illustrate that, Prabhupada gives the example of the sun and the clouds that are in the sky. Without the sun, we don't have clouds in the sky. But the sun doesn't touch the water that then vaporizes and then turns into clouds and comes down as rain. The rays of the sun do that, but the sun doesn't directly do that. Similarly, Lord Vishnu is the cause of the material creation, but he doesn't touch matter. He has no contact. And therefore there's no contamination. Again, going back, like the sun. When the sun contacts some impure place, the aeration and radiation or exposure to the sun is part of the way to purify water. So he gives the example, sun touches a puddle of urine. The sun doesn't become contaminated because it contacts a puddle of urine. Rather, it evaporates the water and the impure thing is left behind. And the sun doesn't become contaminated by that, but it makes the impure pure because of its power. As the power of the sun, what to speak of the power of the source of everything, the internal potency of the Supreme Lord never becomes deteriorated by or affected by material contact. There is no material contact. In the purport, Prabhupada discusses, I'll summarize only, only by devotional service can these things be understood. Brahma realized that earlier. He tried to figure it out by reason and logic and experimental method and came to the conclusion that's not possible. So he selected this devotional approach, and now he has all this nice realization. Then Prabhupada quotes Brahma Samhita, Advaitam Achutim Anadim Anantarupam. The Lord has innumerable Anantarupam, innumerable forms. And they are all in the same category as Garbhadaksha Vishnu. They're without material origin, anadim. They have no beginning. You can't say, once upon a time, Vishnu didn't exist. And then for purpose of creation, boom, he existed. he's an expansion of the Supreme Lord, but that form is anadim, and there's a function. That's the function of creation. And as eternal as the original personality of Godhead is, the Vishnu is eternal, as the Jiva is also eternal. But there are functions for each of these, and therefore we have different names for them according to their what they do, their function. The only way to understand the Lord as He is by devotional service to the Lord, or by approaching the devotee of the Lord, who is always the Lord in his heart. By devotional perfection, one can understand that the impersonal Brahma-jyoti is only the partial representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, and that the three Purusha expansions in the material creation are his plenary portions. Then, just like finish, there's three different sentences and want to emphasize what they say. In the spiritual sky of the Brahma-jyoti, there is no change of various kalpas or millenniums. That's time, because time brings about change. Time brings things into being. Time destroys things and takes them away. It's not just time destroys things, but without time you don't have things coming into being. So in the spiritual sky, there's no time that brings things into being. There's no changes like that. Occasional change, or avikalpam. So kalpa is a measurement of time. In Drutakarma's presentation, he's been traveling in the colleges in the Midwest, making his little tour, and he has a presentation that he does for the colleges and another presentation that he does at temples. And the presentation at temples is more devotional. It's more reference to scriptural things than stones and bones. And he uses that phrase, stones and bones. I don't need stones and bones to convince me, but you know, people that don't have faith in the Vedas, they need some stones and bones. So here's the stones and bones story. And this is what the Vedas say. And in the Vedas, so he speaks of the Vedic conception of time is cyclical, and the unit of time is a kalpa. And then he has these charts of, you know, a kalpa means a day of Brahma, and then there's the night of Brahma, and within the day of Brahma there's so many manus, and 14 manus, and then, you know, 71 divya yugas, so that as a unit within the manus, which is 14 of which makes the unit of a kalpa. So here is avikalpa. And there's no kalpas in that spiritual sky. There's no units of time as we know it in the spiritual sky. There's no time as we know it, nor units of time. It's eternal time. In the spiritual sky of the Brahma-jyoti, there is no change of various kalpas or millenniums, and there are no creative activities in the Vaikuntha worlds, because time brings things into being. As it destroys things, there's no creation in Vaikuntha. It's like eternally existing. The influence of time is conspicuous by its absence. So that's this avikalpa. No occasional change. Next sentence. The rays of the transcendental body of the Lord, the unlimited Brahma-jyoti, are undeterred by the influence of material energy. In fact, it's the other way around. As the rays of the sun make transformations within the elements of other elements of matter in the whole universe, the rays, the Brahma-jyoti rays, they're fully spiritual. There's no influence of time or matter in that Brahmajyoti. And the implication is the spiritual planets are similarly not, and the form of the Lord is similarly not influenced by matter or time, although he has activity. It's not activity like we know activity, because our activity we know it's influenced by matter and time. Last sentence. In the material world also, the initial creator is the Lord himself. He brings about the creation of Brahma, who becomes the subsequent creator empowered by the Lord. So, it's not double talk, it's just how things are. Brahma is the creator, but he's created. And Vishnu is the ultimate creator, and he's not created. So he's the Lord of all lords, Parama Purusha. And that Parama Purusha is a plenary expansion of the original personality of Godhead. That's the Vedic picture. And what Brahma is doing is he's articulating all of this. Now go back, and Maitreya is describing to Vidura about what happened. What happened? How do you know? This is from 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. How do you know what happened before you existed? Answer, you don't. And not only you don't, you can't. You can't experimentally know. So Krishna says to Arjuna in the beginning of the 10th chapter, nobody knows me. The great sages, the demigods, the most learned personalities, they've been working on it for a long time and they don't know me. And they can't know me. It's not possible. Unless there's one possibility, I can disclose it. So I'm going to now disclose it. Here's who I am. And here's what existed before you existed. And there's no, how do you verify that? You can't, by a empiric method, you can't. You can't get in a time machine. That's science fiction. Jules Verne, you go back in the time machine and see what existed before you existed. You can't. Science fiction. But it's knowable, not in theory, but in fact, by disclosure. And that the eligibility for one to have such things disclosed is devotion. And otherwise you won't know. You can be the perhaps maybe program for a long time, but you don't know. So Maitreya is explaining to Vidura what he heard from this line of disciplic succession from Lord Sankarshan, and he was told by Krishna to disclose what Maitreya heard from Krishna, and as well what he heard in disciplic succession to Vidura. So he's just like being an instrument of Krishna's will, and he's just expressing as he heard it. And with some realization beyond, you know, just what he heard. Like, it's not a tape recorder. He's expressing realization. And because we're hearing this conversation between Maitreya and Vidura, we're also being given the same opportunity. The scientist says, mythology. And we look at what the scientist says and we say, really? Once upon a time, there was a singularity. Don't ask me where the singularity came from, it just was. It was a singularity, it's an unlimited amounts of mass compressed in a dimensionless point. Oh, really? And then what happened? All of a sudden there was a big explosion. The singularity exploded. Big bang. Oh, really? What caused the bang? We don't know. But it exploded. And then mass went flying all over the space, and it was hot, and it cooled down, and you know, we got some planets. And then some life evolved on those planets, and we have human beings. Oh, really? Okay. Sounds like mythology to me. Where's the evidence? Well, seems to me that perhaps maybe. Okay, that's your authority, is your power of speculation, and our authority is the Vedas. You can't go back in time and confirm it was a big bang. We can't go back in time and verify that what the Vedas say is true, other than by the process of receiving this knowledge and following the process of purification and getting so many, 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 many confirmations and realizations of what's stated in the Vedas. And that's our system of knowledge. Shabda Brahman. Okay, so that's this morning's class to be continued. Any discussion?
What is the point when the time energy begins to work? Like you mentioned that when the...
It's always working. It's always absent in the spiritual realm. And it's all, even in the unmanifest state, the time energy is operative. The time energy brings things into being. The time energy destroys things. It's the Lord's energy. So during the period of annihilation, the time energy is... Like when you're asleep, your clock is still... And at a certain point you set the alarm and you know, time to get up. Time energy is moving. And it brings things to an unmanifest, it brings things to a manifest state. But it's influences in the material realm. The Lord's external energy. So he's in his internal energy, but when that time energy within the external realm moves to a certain point, the Lord begins to contemplate. He's not obliged to, etc. He's not controlled by, it's his energy. Okay?
You mentioned that the lotus, before the lotus sprouted, from the navel, the time energy was not acting. That's the way to process.
It's language needs to be precise. Time was not operating upon the Lord's existence, but time energy is operating upon his external energy, which is in vyakta and avyakta states. It was operating, but in neither vyakta or avyakta is it. Neither time nor matter are acting upon the Lord. Mm-hmm. But he's aware, he's conscious of what's going on.
Because we are influenced by the material time, we are dead. Influence causes specific conditioning.
Yeah.
And the conditioning is the linear thinking in terms of time.
Sure.
So we cannot use logic in terms of trying to understand Lord Krishna or Lord Vishnu expansions and incarnations. Because
we can't use logic to discern it That's correct. But in order to explain it, you use language. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, this is the limitations of language. Because we think in linear terms, or think in terms of cause and effect. And, you know, we can't think otherwise, and our language implies our way of thinking, or carries the connotation. So that's the limitations of language. But still we can use language to describe.
Yeah.
And we have to be very careful that we use language that conforms to the disclosure of Scripture, because otherwise we're going to do our little editing program. Mm. Anything else?
Couldn't we hear how Lord Brahma was just first trying to figure out, like,
yeah,
the origin, and then he realizes that that's not the way?
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, because this tendency to figure out and analyze is strong.
Yeah.
So where is it coming from, and like how?
Where is it coming from?
Because
it's a conditioned tendency. It's, you know, it's a tool that our rebellious spirit is supplied. There's two tools, karma and jnana. Fruitive endeavor, where does that come from? And speculative tendency, you know, the tendency, there's the natural state of the soul is to enjoy, so we want to enjoy. But if we want to enjoy independent from the Supreme, then this tool is given to us. Work hard. And figure out a way by working hard you can enjoy. Because that's the goal. I want to enjoy. So here's some speculation how you can enjoy, and etc. You can try to enjoy this way, you can try to enjoy. There's a whole variety of how you can try to separately enjoy from the Supreme, and it's all illusion. The speculative tendency will carry you to illusion. We're given that tool. It's a covering of the natural tendency. The natural tendency is to know through devotion, through love. And things are disclosed to us. That's natural. Like the spark in relation to, in conjunction with the fire. The fullness of the glowing capacity of the spark is in conjunction with the fire. But if the spark leaves the fire, then that tendency is diminished. Speculation and fruitive intention, fruitive endeavors, diminishes our full potency.
But I'm seeing that because like I'm getting the answers, like trying to analyze like why things are happening the way it is, and you know, so I feel the pattern is only repeating instead of, you know, like first it is always trying to figure out, and then comes this realization that that's not the way. But because I'm getting the answers most of the time through, you know, trying to analyze, the tendency is only becoming stronger. So
No. There's a difference between, you know, you're just off there on your own in the universe trying to figure it out, and you're hearing from the scripture, and you're doing what scripture says to do and what the acharyas say to do, try to understand. Mm-hmm. But the try to understand is through this descending, here it is, now use your discerning capacity, that's the intellect, to try to understand. That's not off in the universe trying to figure it out. You won't be able to understand simply by your own capacity to understand. But that can be disclosed to you when in devotion you go to the scripture and try to understand. Who is Krishna? What is this message that Krishna is presenting to me? It's not a speculative endeavor. It's quite distinct. It's not cultivation of knowledge. It's It's an act of devotion to trying to understand as Krishna discloses himself or as our acharyas and their commentaries disclose what Krishna is saying. It's not by speculative power. It's by a natural gift or capacity that the soul has to know. And the instruction is, try to understand. It's not by speculation, it's by receiving. And it's to help us understand, which although all that we need is same thing that Brahma did. Just chant your mantra, because that was his tapa, his chanting of Gayatri mantra, the two Gayatris that he received as described in Brahma Samhita. So just chant your mantra. I hope I understand. So to assist us, and Prabhupada would often say like that, all you need to do, you don't have to be a scholarly person, just chant. But if you like, we have so many books. Keep you really busy. But it's not just to keep you busy and keep you out of trouble, it's to satisfy this tendency to want to know, and let that tendency to want to know, which is of the soul, it's not a speculative one, bring it into revealed knowledge where Krishna is disclosing, I am like this. And try to understand as Krishna is disclosing, I am like this. So Prabhupada spent so much time preparing Bhaktivedanta purports and translations to empower that tendency to want to know. Enjoined. Tato Brahma Jigyasa, be inquisitive about Brahman, the absolute truth. As we're being inquisitive, make sure you apply it not in a speculative way, but in receiving this descending knowledge. And that's encouraged, try to understand. That's an act of devotion. That's to be encouraged, not the other. Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, regarding your point about one cannot know or verify God by empirical method, because we didn't exist before. I have a few comments, and then I would like to seek your comments on this. Once I also heard from, when I was at Penn State, in a lecture by His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami. So one point he mentioned was, so to an audience of scientists, students, professors, and so on. He mentioned that if you take any field of science or art or any field, philosophy, and go all the way deep within that field, you will come to the absolute truth. Now, so on the one hand, that comment, and on the other hand, we see today that scientists are, say, for example, looking at the cosmic radiation and saying they're trying to map what was the initial condition at the time of Big Bang and so on. So my understanding is the scientific approach is like trying to look for signatures of, you know, the early parts of creation and then fine-tune it. Here we go, we have the full picture. I'm just wondering, what's wrong with that approach? Will it lead to ultimately to the absolute truth? Why?
Two things. What Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is, "It may, bahunam jamanam ante," but it may not. It's not a guarantee. You just do that, you know, long enough, and you'll come to the right conclusion. Guaranteed. Just keep following that yellow brick road and you'll find the Wizard of Oz. It's not a guarantee. But it may. So the conclusion is one may surrender to Krishna, recognizing that he's the source of everything, Vasudeva Sarvamiti. Samahatma Sadurlabha. It's a very tricky road. And in the course of, you know, many lifetimes, one can easily get deviated and not reach the goal. Second point is, the instruments that we're using are fallible. You know, the mapping of the cosmic radiation, imperfect senses, subject to illusion, cheating propensity, and we have a presupposition. Such persons are not sterile or neutral. They have a presupposition. And we know what that presupposition is. One of the things that very calmly, I was very surprised how calm he was, because Drutta Karma is so deeply involved in this. Maybe it's just like he's matured so much in the area of study that he's doing that he can speak so calmly. The Prabhupada didn't speak so calmly about it. One person asked, as there are so many museums and, like, you know, educational stuff out there for children to have them buy into the, you know, the Darwinian evolution picture, are there other similar things educational for our children, devotee children? You know, they're... His answer was very nice. There isn't. We're not budgeted like the other people are.
Sure.
And the power base is really strong where the other people are. So if something does try to come up, it gets squashed quickly by the machine. But he said that there's this temple of Vedic Planetarium is one such effort when that's completed. And Prabhupada indicated that aside from the cosmos, the picture of evolution, he wanted that to some sections to be, you know, archaeology and cosmology are two areas which, going back without a long deviation, just prior to, or just subsequent to Charles Darwin. I think it was just prior to. Anyway, an article that Sataputra wrote in Bhakti Godhead magazine was detailing somebody, I think it was Macaulay or some Europe, British fellow, that was traveling around Europe saying, you know, the Vedas are bogus. And we'll prove it in the course of time. Two areas that are empiric. Cosmology and anthropology. We're going to find stones and bones that show rubbish. We're going to find cosmology as technology gets better. Rubbish. They say geocentric. That's rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll prove it. You know, that they're just like so far, so off, it's ridiculous. Which will then debunk all the rest of what they say. That was because it was coming from a, according to what the article Sataputra wrote, said, it was coming from a spirit of Christianity-based Europe, where scholars in Europe were looking at the Vedas saying, wow, look at that body of knowledge. And the Christian scholars were saying, well, wait a minute, we don't want this competition, let's debunk it. So these two areas, but it's not proof, but it's evidence. You know, this is the Vedic picture, and it's a different picture, but then it explains everything very tangibly, and, you know, scholars all over the world are going to come and try to poke holes in it. So that's why they have to really get it down carefully. But because just as our Vaishnav scholars are doing with what, you know, the empirical scholars are doing. But there's no what Bhakti Tirtha Swami said was encouraging to those people, but it's not necessarily a fact. that they just keep plowing ahead long enough and they'll reach the same conclusion. It's possible to reach the same conclusion. Krishna's the source of everything. But that's like a very refined and quality scholar. So what Dhrutakarma said is, in relation to education, we have seen that there are persons that are following the empiric method and they reach this other conclusion. And we find that there are empiric scholars that the evidence points to something else. That there is an intelligent design behind the whole thing. Didn't like just use the word intelligent design, but there's an intelligence behind the systems of things. And the other explanations are not pointing to that. Evidence doesn't point to that in their estimate. So his point was both should be presented. They should have a place. Theology is one thing, philosophy is another, and science is another. It was very well laid out. And in science, those who are genuine scientists, there's a whole history of people. He pointed to even in Darwin, in the Origin of the Species, he speaks of our Creator's work. There's a place for God, even in Charles Darwin, but you know today there can't be. There's something wrong with people that have a predisposition against where the evidence points to. But that's where we are today in academia. Maya Pratyagana, just as Krishna says and Prabhupada points out. The knowledge is stolen away by illusion. So there's not a guarantee that they'll reach there.
So science has been hijacked pretty much by
criminals.
Who have a bias on
them. They're asuras who, you know, have their stronghold in the scientific community or academia, and they, you know, they're well defensed, and they have, you know, real strong artillery and air force and navy. You know, they're militaristic pirates, powerful. And there, you have something?
Okay. I had something slightly unrelated to today's class. I don't know whether I should ask.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
See the Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Yeah.
Yeah.